United States for the Fair's Big Pan American Livestock Exposition. And these are champions of the dairy cattle division. They're the finest of their breed. Now these Grand Champion jerseys here, they're worth about $15,000 a pair. Here's royalty, folks. They're champions of the beef cattle division. They're the best of $1 million worth of purebred cattle here at the fair. Short horn. Ready. Raymond, they've got sweat glands. They can stand the Texas heat. Now, meet up with the Grand Champion Santa Gertrude. They're a breed developed right here in Texas, down on the King Ranch. That big bull, he weighs a ton. The pair of them are worth probably $25,000. Now, the junior livestock.
First place.
Did he?
Got
it. What do you expect to win with it in here, a blue ribbon?
I hope so.
Well, I certainly hope you do, too. If you win a blue ribbon, you'll be a prime steer. You'll have to just be some produce. And of course, that's got to be people like to eat, too. And you boys are doing a good job to bring that kind of beef to us here at this Pan American Livestock Exposition at the State Fair of Texas. And we're looking for a big show next week. And I certainly hope that you get the price for this year. What do you expect to get for it?
I expect about 40 to 45 cents more.
Well, I hope you can get it. We'll try to get it for you. And it's big and it's smooth. What do you weigh?
He weighs 11.50.
What do you weigh when you got him?
Because it might have made him feel bad, but we really do have to go. Music by J.J. Johnson and Kay Winding, live from...
horses in this final here is worth between, $15,000 to $25,000.
Fine, man. About how long does, from the time you start until you finish, does it take this horse to get to be a polished horse?
Well, the time you actually start cutting cattle on them, it takes a good time.
Oh, the kids' rides, geez. That's when the memory starts, you know. There's memories being made right on the rides. Wonder whatever happened. I guess that's the caterpillar crawl. Of course, there are rides for adults, too. And guided tours by special kinds of people like our friend and father. Well, there's a new one. Well, no, blood and fog. There's much to it, but it looks so good. And it also be lining up and picking up and buying tickets along with all the girls. There's our ticket, right?
The moon can be seen today. Now let us take a walk to the rim of the canyon and look out over it. No school, and lots of swimming in the rivers and the ditches. Anyway, dreams of great achievements, wondrous discoveries, far travels, long voyages, wealth and fame and high honor, dreams of love, and love itself, real, unexpected, unfamiliar, strange, and forever after, unforgettable. Wonderful. There is no other word for it in English. In Armenian, we might say, Rajali. At its best, it's almost unbelievable in its shabby dignity and its shy grandeur. My boyhood? Yes, I'm afraid so. But perhaps not mine at all. Perhaps, in essence, any man's. The streets are full of men who were born great and lived to prove it. And memory is crowded with great men who died young and didn't need to prove anything.
Artie Shaw's Concerto for Clarinet. This is Monitor, NBC's new radio service, and this is Albert, your Jazz Bo Collins friend. It is Will You Still Be Mine?
once again. Now I'm just an old lone, some rolling stone.
Jolly, J-O-L-L-Y, plays with a lot of elasticity and a lot of percussion, and has definitely a singular personality. Pete Jolly.
And we are going to win the peace that follows.
This album, then, is the story of the search for that peace, of the first 3 years of the atomic age, of the phenomenon of...
Children, I know you're all disappointed today that you didn't get the funnies. So gather around. Here's Dick Tracy. Let's see what Dick Tracy is doing. Now, get this picture. Here is Wet Wash. The doors of the laundry wagon are open. He's leaning with his back toward the old wagon. And he's counting his money. 2, 3, 4,000. Now he's getting into the hundreds. 600, 700, 800. And the picture shows a hand of Breathless. She's got hold of that iron pot. Remember the iron pot she took from the Van Hoosen? And crash! She crashes it on his head. Knocked out. Next picture we see Dick Tracy. You know the fine type of Dick Tracy? He's been a detective so long. And he still has that slender form. Lou Valentine, why do our detectives get fat, I wonder? And say, children, what does it all mean? It means that dirty money never brings any luck.
The reconversion to peace was not easy. We had a surplus of Sherman tanks, B-17s, K-rations, generals, and olive drab material. We had an acute shortage of trains to bring the boys home, a shortage of new cars, washing machines, white shirts, and a worldwide shortage of competent men for the peace table. We also had a nervous ally in Moscow.
While the London Foreign Minister's conference was a failure, Molotov pointed out that the Allies had differences during the war and always found the right solution in the end. This was the most hopeful note he struck. Russia believed she did most to win the war and that she should have most to say in making the peace.
That was H.V. Kaltenborn in November of 45. Hank Greenberg changed uniforms in time to help win the World Series for Detroit. They finally gave Cordell Hull the Nobel Peace Prize. But the peacemakers still had work to do in Iran, Indonesia, and Greece.
The Russian demand that British troops be withdrawn from Greece is only a move in the propaganda campaign against the British, which the Russians are conducting all through Eastern Europe. The immediate objective of that campaign is to support the traditional Russian push toward warm water. But it may also be aimed at weakening and discrediting democratic socialism, of which England is now the strongest bulwark.
That was Elmer Davis early in 46. What was to be a three-month strike was on at General Motors. And people who read books were somewhere between the lost weekend and peace of mind.
Behind the scenes of the next world war, London. The big three are again in diplomatic convulsions. Russia is insistent upon becoming an African power, which Great Britain will resist to the last ounce of strength. When one lifeline crosses another lifeline, the result is a noose for world peace. Paris. Diplomatic relations between the Vatican and the Kremlin are very, very bad. They will get very, very much worse.
That was Winchell in February. So this was peace. In retrospect now, it seems like a nightmare. In fewer months than it took us to lose Corregidor, we seem to be losing the peace on point. By March, nerve ends were frayed. Andre Gromyko walked out of the UN for the first time. And on the fifth day of March, the phrase Iron Curtain was born at Westminster College.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere. And all our subjects, in one form or another, not only to Soviet influence, but to a very high and in some cases increasing measure of control from Moscow.
Winston Churchill, no longer Prime Minister, delivered the most startling warning of a startling career.
The population of the English-speaking Commonwealth be added to that of the United States, with all that such cooperation implies, in the air, on the sea, all over the globe, if all British moral and material forces and convictions are joined with your own in fraternal association, the high roads of the future will be clear. Not only for us, but for all. Not only for our time, but for a century to come.
We take you now to Operation Crossroads. Albert Einstein had said, against an atomic explosion, there is no real defense. And most other scientists had agreed with him. On June 30th, 46, we exploded the new bomb over Bikini Lagoon to determine what it could do and what human beings could do to protect themselves against it.
All of the observer ships are in position in the open sea. We're about 10 miles away. I can
see the target.
4, 3, 2, 1...
its destructive power. Bernard M. Baruch.
I was moved in the afternoon of my life, shall I say in the last, in the late afternoon of my life, to add my effort to gain the world's quest by the broad mandate under which we were created. We of this nation, desirous of helping to bring peace to the world, and realizing the heavy obligations upon us arising from our possession of the means of producing the bomb, are prepared to make our full contribution toward effective control of atomic energy. We propose this. One, manufacture of atomic bombs shall stop.
Mr. Baruch, speaking for the United States, also proposed destroying all existing bombs and the sharing of our atomic know-how, provided adequate international control and inspection could be established.
Комиссия по контролю над атомной энергией, созданная согласно решению Московской
конференции... USSR, in the voice of Andrei Gromyko, found the Baruch plan unacceptable.
...решению первой сессии Генеральной Ассамблеи должна приступить к практическому осуществлению поставленных...
MacArthur remained in command in Japan. Marshall was in China trying to bring peace between Chiang Kai-shek and the communists. The Council of Foreign Ministers failed for the fourth time in Paris. Hamburger was a dollar a pound when you could get it. OPA lay dying, and when it was finally dead, Truman blamed Congress and the Congress blamed Truman. And in Nuremberg, Germany, humanity prepared its case against those who had so nearly destroyed it.
I will now call upon the defendants to plead guilty or not guilty to the charges against them. Hermann Wilhelm Göring.
Ich kenne mich im Sinne der Anklage nicht schuldig.
Rudolf Hess.
Nein.
That will be entered as a plea of not guilty. Joachim von Ribbentrop.
Ich kenne mich im Sinne der Anklage für nicht schuldig.
These were the heirs to Hitler's guilt, as they might have been to his victory.
Nicht schuldig.
Hjalmar Schacht.
These were the heroes of Lidigy, Felsen, Buchenwald, and Malmedy. All 21 defendants pled not guilty, and a few Americans found it possible to agree with them. Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson, our chief prosecutor, spoke for most of us.
If you were to say of these men that they are not guilty, it would be as true to say there has been no war, there are no slain, there have been no crimes.
All but three of the defendants were found guilty.
This is Arthur Gates reporting from Nuremberg for the Combined American Network. I was an eyewitness to the execution of the wilted, spoiled flower of Nazism, but I only saw 10 Nazis die. Wilhelm Hermann Göring, guilty on all four counts, the man whom Justice Jackson described as half militarist and half gangster, escaped his fate of hanging by committing suicide at 10:45 last night, less than 3 hours before he would have been executed.
In France, De Gaulle was out of power. In Washington, the last two members of the Roosevelt cabinet, Ickes and Wallace, were out. 400,000 coal miners were out of the pit, and John L. Lewis... The breach between the East and the West has widened. We have a new phrase for it now, the Cold War. A state of threat and counter-threat of displaced persons, of hunger and the violation of human rights. Our friends and allies in Western Europe were near collapse. All the hopes and prayers of VJ Day were dying in the icy wastes of this Cold War. Only we in this country had power and opportunity.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Secretary of State.
The scene, Harvard University. It might have been just another commencement speech by just another general, but it was the utterance of a soldier statesman. Churchill called it the most unsordid act in history. George Catlett Marshall proposes the plan that came to bear his name.
It is logical that the United States should do whatever it is able to do to assist in the return of normal economic health in the world. Our policy is directed not against any country or doctrine, but against hunger, poverty, desperation, and chaos, so as to permit the emergence of political and social conditions in which free institutions can exist. Any government that is willing to assist in the task of recovery will find full cooperation, I am sure, on the part of the United States government. Any government which maneuvers to block the recovery of other countries cannot expect help from us.
Washington, D.C. has often been called a state of mind. In its post-war state, it was a nervous mind, overworked, hypertense, reflecting in a concentrated cell the case of national jitters. Certainly, there was no better symptom of this hysteria than the Congressional Investigating Committee. For every conviction, there were a dozen shattered names. A few were strong enough to walk out bigger men than when they entered, and one almost wrecked the committee which investigated him. On the witness stand now, Howard Hughes, the Senate War Investigating Committee, the Senator, Homer Ferguson of Michigan.
Do you know where Mr. Myers is?
Myers?
Yes. John Myers.
Oh, Myers?
Yes.
No,
Myers.
Don't.
He works for you, does he not, Mr. Hughes?
He works for my company.
It may be funny to you that he isn't here.
I didn't laugh, Senator. Somebody laughed back there.
Well, he's in your employ. Do you think that Mr. Myers in business at the present time is more important than this committee hearing?
Well, it's more important than my company, I can tell you that.
Who in your company will know the whereabouts of Mr. Myers at the present time?
I don't know that, but you've had him here for unlimited questioning, and I've brought him back here twice from abroad. I don't see why I should do any more than that. just to accommodate you so you can put him up here beside me on the stand and make a publicity show out of it.
Well, is that the reason he is not here?
No, that is not the reason, but I think it's the reason you want him back.
Well, I have some questions that I want to ask.
Why didn't you ask him while he was here? I brought him here twice from abroad for you.
Well, now, will you see that Mr. Myers comes in at the 2 o'clock session?
What, today?
Yeah.
No, I don't think I will.
1947 was the year of the flying saucers, of the Taft-Hartley law, the Cookie-Lavagetto double in the World Series, and the 16th veto. It was also the year in which most of us felt 10 years older. We remembered Elizabeth as a child of 11 at the time of her father's coronation. When we looked again, she was 21 and a full-grown princess at Westminster.
Take thee, Elizabeth, son of Mary.
Take thee, Elizabeth, son of
Mary. To my wedded wife.
My wedded wife.
To have and to hold.
To have and to
from this day forward.
Princess Elizabeth and the Duke of Edinburgh.
Take thee, Philip. To my wedded husband. To have and to hold. From this day forward.
The royal wedding was a rare moment of relaxation in a dull, drab, austere England. But the crown the future queen would wear had lost its brightest jewel, and India had lost its father.
This is the All India Radio. Prime Minister Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru.
Friends and comrades, the light has gone out of our lives, and there is darkness everywhere. And I do not quite know what to tell you, and how to say it. Our beloved leader, Bapu as we called him, the father of the nation, is no more.
Gandhi had fought history's first passive rebellion and won. Now, perhaps in studying his armaments, the world might yet find the only permanent defense against the atom.
For the youth of the world, we will be proud of the victory, which again, of course, will be brought into being by the very youth of all the United Nations.
The United States, which always had a warm spot in its heart for both Czechoslovakia and Masaryk, felt the double-barreled charge that both were dead on almost the same day. The tragedy of Jan Masaryk was the tragedy of our time, and of every other nation that tried to compromise with a Russia that was as incapable of compromise as it was of true democracy.
We were willing to die for an ideal, and we would die for it again. But we prefer living for it, working for it, safeguarding it.
Masaryk spoke those words just a short time before his death on the flagged courtyard beneath his window in Prague. It is impossible now to know whether it was suicide or murder, just as we shall never know for sure how the peace dies if we lose it. The Russians took Czechoslovakia from the inside. It looked like a cheap victory, but it welded the West into a determination to resist, and on April 3rd, we were officially committed to the Marshall Plan. Republican Senator Arthur Vandenberg helped convince Congress and most Americans that $46 per capita was a good buy for a healthy Europe. When Italy went to the polls in April, American aid, the intervention of the church, may have been decisive, but the ghost of Masaryk and his martyred nation cast ballots.
This is Howard K. Smith in Rome. The final and official results of the Italian election are now in. The Gasparese Christian Democratic Party has polled 48.7% of the popular vote. And this, together with votes polled by splinter parties, give the Gasparese Party control of the Chamber of Deputies. The Communists got 31% of the total popular vote.
And there were sounds from the Holy Land. The British flag came down over Palestine, and a war began. Amidst the rumblings of battle, the ceremonial ram's horn, the shofar, was heard. And after 2,000 years, Israel was reborn. You are listening to the hymn, Hatikvah, as it was broadcast from Tel Aviv just a few moments after the proclamation of Israel's independence.
Ukiratem Zeror Baharet Vechol Yosheveha.
In English, proclaim liberty throughout the land and to all the inhabitants thereof. Those identical words from the Old Testament appear on the Liberty Bell in Independence Hall, Philadelphia.
And today in Washington, large crowds and many fireworks are expected as Jimmy Petrillo goes before the House Labor Committee.
Outside of Hughes and Lilienthal, the witness facing the barrage of Klieg lights, cameras, and microphones who did best by himself was James Caesar Petrillo. Some people called Petrillo the benefactor of every man that ever blew a horn.
I have dictated my life as a musician to this country, and I shall continue to do so, and I shall serve them honestly and faithfully so long as they elect me their president on a Democratic ballot.
But there were other opinions.
Well, if that's true, tell me this. Why have you earned the reputation of being a czar and a dictator?
Well, that's not a long story. I talked to the National Association of Broadcasters. We're through 2 years ago. Every time I see him. Oh, Jimmy. You're the squarest guy we ever did business with. You know why we like you?
He said that yesterday.
Yeah, we're open and above board, Jimmy. You know, you tell us the truth. And you're no thief. You don't ask for any money. You're just a swell guy. Fine, let's have a drink. We have a drink. But don't tell the papers that we did today. No, I won't say anything. Boom, headlines tomorrow morning. Who stole the papers? Nobody knows.
Mr. Petrillo, no modest man, seemed to be having the time of his life.
I think I'm doing pretty good up to now. Everybody wants to get in the act.
The Cold War had much of the tragedy and all of the logistics of a fighting war. It had its theaters of operations, its fifth columns, its propaganda teams, its D-Days, and it had its sieges.
Roger Field 9, your latest Templehawk weather is unlimited, tire broken, 7 miles, wind northwest at 6, all center setting is 3001, landing is 270.
The siege of Berlin began on June 26, 1948, and lasted 328 days.
09, now perform your final cockpit check, get on and lock, check and set your gyro, over.
The command decisions were made in Moscow and Washington, but the objective was Berlin, now divided into eastern and western sectors. When the Big Four failed to settle the dispute of Berlin, the Russians, believing the Allied position there to be vulnerable, both militarily and economically, clamped a railroad and highway blockade upon its 2 million inhabitants. For a few hours, our position was untenable. For a day, it was impossible. Then, for 328 days, it was a miracle of air power. American and British forces, operating from bases in Frankfurt and Hamburg, lifted supplies for 2 million Germans to an island deep within the Soviet zone. A city the size of Philadelphia was supplied for a year completely by air. Cargo planes, usually C-54s, touch down a Tempelhof aerodrome every 3 minutes. A quarter of a million missions in every conceivable kind of weather. Payloads of 18,000 pounds of coal, wheat, milk, and drugs.
Roger, do not acknowledge any further instructions. Steer right now to a heading of one. Correction, steer right now to a heading of two.
In all, 5 billion pounds of supplies were flown in by Operation Bittle to keep democracy from perishing in a city that had watched it die twice in one generation. There were youngsters, some of them had been shooting marbles at the time of Munich, who flew as many as 400 missions in this battle which may yet prove to be the payoff in the Cold War. And there were other chinks in the Iron Curtain. That is the voice of Marshal Tito of Yugoslavia, an old communist, Moscow trained, but the only head of a satellite state to fight fascism in his own valleys and mountains. And in this speech, he denies that a communist must accept domination from the Kremlin. And along Manhattan's east side, ground was being broken for the future home of the United Nations. Now, 7 nations richer than at San Francisco and 27 vetoes poorer. The United Nations became a marketplace of debate and insult, where the language of diplomacy was devalued almost as fast as the world's currency. Listen to Andrei Vashinsky telling the United Nations that the U.S. was warmongering. And one day, the woman who had been the first lady of the land and who would become the first lady of the world lent her stature to the devaluation process. Delegate Eleanor Roosevelt, as she spanked the Russians for saying that American women were kitchen slaves.
The Soviet delegate at Paris said that the Soviet women, desiring to accompany their foreign husbands abroad, must be kept at home for their own good, which doesn't seem exactly to go with some of the other arguments. He charged that in other countries, they would be subject to poor living conditions and exploitation as kitchen slaves. That is, their husbands might expect them to do some housework. My recollection is that he said they would be obliged to wash the dishes. We might ask, by the way, who does the housework in the Soviet Union? Is it always done by the men, or are all the services done by some communal arrangement?
On the map of China, the communists were spreading like a red stain down toward the Yangtze. It became increasingly clear that the incompetent, corrupt government of Chiang Kai-shek, which had enjoyed our support, was not supported by the Chinese people. Our policy was to wait until the dust settled. When that would be, and what would then be revealed, no man could say. And there were more hearings in Washington and more witnesses. The Hollywood Ten, William Remington, Elizabeth Bentley, and the fantastic case of Whittaker Chambers and Alger Hiss.
J. David Whittaker Chambers. I'm a senior editor at the Time magazine.
My name is Alger Hiss. I am here at my own request to deny unqualifiedly various statements about me which were made before this committee by one Whittaker Chambers day before yesterday.
Whittaker Chambers, a high-salaried, successful editor, accused Alger Hiss, the highly competent State Department official, of being both a communist and a conspirator against the government. No case before any committee or court ever had two more conflicting witnesses.
As a member of the Communist Party from 1924 until about 1937 or 1938.
That was Chambers. Now, Hiss.
I am not and never have been a member of the Communist Party.
You were very fond of Mr. Hiss?
Indeed, I was. Perhaps my closest friend. Certainly the closest friend I ever had in the Communist Party.
To the best of my knowledge, I never heard of Whittaker Chambers until in 1947, when two representatives of the Federal Bureau of Investigation asked me if I knew him and various other people. I said I did not know Chambers. So far as I am aware, I have never laid eyes on him, and I should like to have the opportunity to do so.
Finally, the two men faced each other before the committee.
Mr. Hiss, would you kindly stand up, please? Mr. Chambers, would you stand up? Mr. Hiss, have you ever seen this individual who is standing?
I have.
Do you know him?
I identify him.
As who?
As George Crosby.
We were close friends. We're a court in a tragedy of history.
Except, as I have indicated, the statements about me made by Mr. Chambers are complete fabrications. I think my record in the government service speaks for itself.
Chambers accused Hiss of stealing vital state secrets for the Communist Party, cited a Model A Ford and a rent-free apartment as symbols of their association. Hiss denied the charges categorically, called Chambers a deadbeat who just never paid for the car or his rent.
a startled, shocked public could be sure of but one thing. One of these two men was the most convincing, calculating, and cool liar in the history of Washington hearings. The big story of 1948 was the presidential election. But it had a prologue, which for almost a year kept plans for both political conventions in a state of arrested development.
General, have you seen these buttons? Is there a 5-mile movement?
I saw one once, but the boy ran.
Do you think this is the way to
General Dwight D. Eisenhower, whose word had been law to the most awesome collection of admirals and generals ever assembled under one emblem, found it almost impossible to convince a mere handful of American reporters that when he said no, he meant no.
General, if one of the nominating conventions should put your name up for the presidency, would you accept?
Last January, I wrote a letter, which I assume most of you here have read. In it, I expressed myself completely and positively on this subject. Nothing since the writing of that letter has occurred to change my mind with respect to that subject.
And at this point, we're going to pause once again for...
Will the delegates please be seated?
This time, there were three political conventions. All were hot, noisy, crowded, smoky, delegates, and filled with the kind of oratory heard only in convention halls.
My fellow Americans, we are back in Philadelphia to name the next president of the United States.
Claire Booth Luce was one of the spearheads of the throng of radiantly enthusiastic Republicans who came to Philadelphia.
Then there is the center, or the Pendergrass wing of the Democratic Party. That's run by the Wampum and the Boodle Boys, the same big city bosses who gave us Mr. Truman in one of their more pixelated moments.
Then the long orations and the nominations.
My senior colleague in the Senate, the Honorable Robert A. Taft of Ohio. The man America needs and wants, Harold E. Sasson. America's next president, Thomas E. Dewey.
I nominate Douglas MacArthur, a recognized statesman, the Honorable Senator Arthur E. Vandenberg.
Taft, Sasson, and Dewey went into the final heat in a bitter professional race for the nomination. And when the shouting was done, Thomas E. Dewey stood in the victor's circle for the second time in 4 years.
In all humility, I accept the nomination. I'm happy to be able to say to you that I come to you unfettered by a single obligation or promise to any living person.
The Democratic Convention was a dull, moody, defeated affair, save for the few moments when tired old Alvin Barkley was able to lift the delegates out of their lethargy.
What is a bureaucrat? A bureaucrat is a Democrat who holds an office that some Republican wants.
The civil rights issue split the Democratic Party wide open, and Handy Ellis of Alabama led the walkout.
The South is no longer going to be the whipping boy of the Democratic Party. And you know that without the votes of the South, you cannot elect the President of the United States.
And therefore, they join with us. And we bid you goodbye.
Goodbye, Harry.
Goodbye, Harry.
Harry Truman waited in an alley outside the convention hall for 3 long hours, until 3 a.m., when it was finally possible to tell him that he was the party's choice.
Senator Barkley and I will win this election, and make these Republicans like it. Don't you forget that.
But there was one more convention to come.
Everyone wants Wallace, Henry Henry Wallace, Henry Henry Wallace in the White House.
The Wallace Convention, or the Progressive Party Convention, was a paradox of crew-cut youngsters in T-shirts on the convention floor and seasoned left-wing organizers in the committee rooms. The young ones paraded and sang, and the committees laid down the political plank for a naive Henry Wallace to walk.
I am committed to stopping the creation of fear, to using all my powers to prevent the fearmakers from the red issue. Millions know, and millions more must see, that it is not the Kremlin, not the communists who have sent milk to 24 cents a quart and meat to $1.30 a pound, that it is the red issue and not the red who did this to us.
And when Glenn Taylor was nominated as vice president, he brought his wife and three children with him and sang his acceptance.
I love you as I never loved before. My dream of love is won.
The presidential sweepstakes began soon after Labor Day as the campaign trains carried the candidates out across the vast continent, just as they had every 4 years since Lincoln's time. But to the experts, it was all just a formality. The splinters of the Wallace left and the Dixiecrat right had left the Democratic center so weakened that bookmakers were giving 15-1 odds on Dewey. The People's Pulse had been taken, charted, predicted, and cataloged, and they were told exactly whom they would elect and by what majority. But it couldn't hurt to watch the campaign anyhow.
I'm Harriet Truman. I work for the government, and I'm trying to keep my job. We're out to win this election, and we're going to do that on the second day of November.
We're going to have a spring house cleaning in January. We're going to have the biggest untangling, unsnarling, weeding, and pruning operation in our history.
He opened his mouth, and he closed his eyes. And he swallowed the terrible record of that good-for-nothing 80th Congress.
The next administration is going to go forward to make more adequate provisions against the hazards of old age and unemployment.
He said in this campaign that he's for a minimum wage. And I think the smaller the minimum, the better it suits you.
These misnamed Democrats who pretend to be labor's friends ask for power to put labor in chains. And that's the reason they ought to be thrown out of office.
When the Republican candidate finished telling you here
in... 1-1 odds on Dewey. The People's Pulse had been taken, charted, predicted, and cataloged, and they were told exactly whom they would elect and by what majority. But it couldn't hurt to watch the campaign anyhow.
I'm Harriet Truman. I work for the government, and I'm trying to keep my job. We're out to win this election, and we're going to do that on the second day of November.
We're going to have a spring house cleaning in January. We're going to have the biggest untangling, unsnarling, weeding, and pruning operation in our history.
He opened his mouth, and he closed his eyes. And he swallowed the terrible record of that good-for-nothing 80th Congress.
The next administration is going to go forward to make more adequate provisions against the hazards of old age and unemployment.
He said in this campaign that he's for a minimum wage. And I think the smaller the minimum, the better it suits you.
These misnamed Democrats who pretend to be labor's friends ask for power to put labor in chains. And that's the reason they ought to be thrown out of office.
When the Republican candidate finished telling you here in Pittsburgh how labor had suffered under my administration, he told you who had come to the rescue of labor. Now, how do you suppose they did it? They did it with the Taft-Hartley law. That's how they came to the rescue of labor.
As never before, we need a rudder to our ship of state, and we need a firm hand at the tiller. Now, I am sorry to say, reached a new low of mudslinging. That is the kind of campaign I have refused to wage, and I never will.
Well, if it's mudslinging, to go out to the people of the United States, in every corner of the United States, and nearly every state and union, and tell them what the facts of life are, then I'm a mudslinger.
On November 1st, the trains and the candidates were silent. The race was over. Now the people would decide. H.V. Kaltenborn, the dean of commentators, was not alone in believing that the Republicans couldn't lose. But Terry was listening to H.V., and this was his version of that unforgettable night.
I had my sandwich and glass of buttermilk and went to bed at 6:30. And along about 12 o'clock, I happened to wake up for some reason, and the radio was turned on, and Mr. Kaltenborn was saying, "Well, the president is a million votes ahead in the popular vote we have yet to get." And we are very sure that when the country vote comes in, Mrs. Truman will be defeated by another funding vote. And I went back to bed and went to sleep. Around about 10 o'clock, I got a telegram that said that the election was over, and that I should be congratulated on the fact that I had won the election. Apparently, it's too bad, but it happened.
The victory was his. Almost alone, he had won the most responsible position in the world. The victory restored to many of us, Democrats and Republicans alike, a sense of the importance of the individual. We were not predictable. The people were still sovereign. We were more than dots on a pollster's graph. As a nation, we had come into our full inheritance. We were a nation beset by domestic discord. The world viewed us with a mixture of admiration and fear. We did not know where we were going, but more than ever before, we knew that our destination was to be decisive. For this nation, it must be greatness or failure. And the time for greatness was now.
And thus, for the 55 minutes preceding, the Goodwill Station has brought you in its entirety, Volume 2 of an album entitled I Can Hear It Now, with excerpts from history recorded from 1945 through 1949, narrated by Edward R. Murrow. I really hope that you've enjoyed this portrait.
Participation here this evening. We are going to have everything from symphony to tap. And now, the show is on.
Bless me, Mr. Mayor. What do you mean by a system? I mean a close political machine. A machine that has the power to reach his hand out and select an individual and say, "You're the candidate." And this person, regardless of how he may feel individually, but knowing full well that any office that he has held has been through this same machine, has no choice in the matter but to accept. And then this machine wages an effective campaign in his behalf. And he is elected. And then this machine, with a cold eye, looks at him after election and says, "We selected you. We elected you. Your picture is in the paper. You're on the front page. Who are you? You're nothing. You're nobody. You
it
all to us."
He was simply to try to pull up when I saw things going down. I can assure you it was all in a day's work. And perhaps, I think you'll all believe this, if I had deliberated, perhaps I wouldn't have said some of the things that I do say and shall continue to say from time to time. So, say something you know that it's mine and that no one studied about it and considered it and then gave it to me.
This has been part
of the same kind of folks that you've left back home, whether in the West, in the South, or in the North, or up in New England. You'll find real folks here in New York.
Pierre LaGuardia was born in Greenwich Village.
The immigrants built them. When I was a boy out West, I saw the first railroad come in there in Arizona in the early 90s. What were they? Mexicans and Italians. $1.25 a day, working 10 and 12 hours. And if he was injured, he lost his job. Who do you suppose built this country? Immigrants. And there's still a great deal to do.
With the Spanish American.
The diplomatic service 37 years ago. But, you know, I had a queer fault. I like to tell the truth, so I wasn't a success in the diplomatic service. Farmers!
I know you're all disappointed today that you didn't get the funnies. So gather around, and I'll tell you about Dick Tracy today. Here's Dick Tracy. Let's see what Dick Tracy is doing. Now, get this picture. Here is Red Wash. The doors of the laundry wagon are open. He's leaning with his back toward me.
We have minor knife, wild cord, and diminished
fit. The administration of Port Authority and fear.
The main thing is that it has become very, very serious. Now let's listen to a serious, modern, progressive arrangement of our old friend, Sweet Sue. Simply because it is being played by jazz men on jazz instruments, and it has its roots in the soil of jazz and not in the soil of Bach. Now, where does this lead us in our investigation? There are those who have concluded from all of this that here in this new weird jazz is the beginning, the real beginning of serious American music, and that the American composer has finally found his own expression. Of course, when they say this, they are intimating that all the symphonic works of all kinds of American composers, myself included, are nothing but stylized, personalized imitations of the European symphonic tradition. Sometimes I must say, I almost think they're right. They may have a point, but point or no point, I found myself recently in the same position, writing a concert piece for jazz band. This is the piece we referred to earlier in the session. We're going to play it for you now. It is called Prelude, Fugue, and Riffs. It's in three short continuous sections, a prelude for the brass alone, then a short fugue for the five saxophones, and then riffs for everybody. In one way or another, it uses all the elements we have been discussing during this time. I hope you will feel in it some of the special beauty of jazz that I felt when I was writing the piece.
Following his return from UNRWA, his family needed the money.
Before Fiorello became too ill, he kept very active and busy. He was at home. Most of the time, and he was writing an article for one of the newspapers.
He had been unconscious. And there was nothing to do there but to go and inquire and sit and wait. Every kind of person was. His body lay in state in the Cathedral of St. John the Divine.
Tomorrow we'll be on the job again. I hope nothing happens tonight. I don't think it will because the weather's in our favor. And I want you to know that your city's on the job. The police, the fire department, you're just working hard. There are no more hours, you know, for city employees. We just have to work and have to work all the time. Now, carry on, be cheerful, cooperate, and I'll talk to you again very soon. Good night.